like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing,
everything the traffic will allow.
Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow.
Good evening, I'm Ted O'Brien, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. It's summertime. A good time to reflect on a theater season just completed and to look to what we may expect in the new season and the years ahead. How has theater in Boston changed over the years? Where is it going? What companies are taking it there? These are some of the questions we hope to answer with the help of our guests. First, from the Sugan Theater Company, Artistic Director Carmel O'Reilly. From the Lyric Stage Company, Producing Artistic Director Spiro Valutis. And from WBUR, theater critic Bill Marks. Welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas.
It's good to be here.
What is Boston Theater today? What's available? What can we see when we go out there, when we look at this vast smorgasbord?
Well, I think you put it best by saying it's a vast smorgasbord. I think you can see anything and everything in Boston, from the smallest sort of storefront theater to the large touring productions. Part of, I think, what the problem when we ask questions like what's Boston theater is that we are stuck with the idea that Boston is a tryout town. Because for years, that was theater in Boston. It was in the theater district, and that was it. And since I've been in Boston now for almost 25 years, both as a student first and now as a professional, that has changed over the landscape. In terms of resident theater companies in Boston, the oldest is 31 years old. And that's not when you compare that to the Symphony or the MFA, there's a whole different kind of tradition of going to those institutions as opposed to going to a theatrical institution. But if you want to see a small experimental production in Boston, you can see that. If you want to see a solid mid-sized theater company doing very good work, you can see that. If you want to go to a large resident theater company, you can see that. I'm going to disagree with my colleague at the end of the table there that the only regional theaters in Boston are ART and the Huntington, according to the Theater Communications Group, which is a service organization for regional theater. There are six categories of regional theater, of which two are represented at this table as well as the Huntington and ART. We have this mindset that larger is better, and that's not quite what I think is right, especially about Boston.
Well, so in other words, we should be talking about commercial theater, Broadway road shows, academic theater, new theater, community theater when we talk about Boston theater. Is that accurate, Carmel?
I think that's very accurate. There's a broad spectrum of groups performing. What's interesting to me, I'm just listening to Spiro talking about the changes in theater here. I have not been in Boston for 25 years in theater, more like, well, we're 10 years in existence now, so 12 years. And during that time, what I have seen and experienced with our small theater group, which has grown in that 10 years, is the rise of small theater. It's been, in the last couple of years, quite extraordinary. For a while, it seemed that it was difficult to survive. It was a hard town to crack. Most, if people did go to theater, they did tend to go out to the regional theaters or a theater that was much more established. And I think that the face of theater in that respect in Boston is changing. And that is also reflecting in the fact that some of the bigger theaters are now seeking out smaller spaces. And maybe it's something to do with even the kind of plays that are coming to us, that some of these plays are the intimacy is there. And that may have to do actually in some indirect way with budgeting, with the fact that big theaters can't put on restoration comedies anymore because the demands and the budgets are so huge. So a lot of the new playwrights are actually sometimes writing within the confines that demand small casts.
Right,
and small casts need small space. And so there's a burgeoning of small theater, very exciting small theater.
Thank you, Carmel O'Reilly. All right. So we have this bubbling stew going out here and various components in that stew. But
bubbling
Bill Marks,
cauldron, perhaps, more accurate.
How does Boston compare to other second fiddle cities, assuming that New York is the fiddle, like Chicago or Los Angeles or Minneapolis? Do we have more, less, more original productions?
I guess to put it in the context of other cities, I'd say, unlike, let's say, even Chicago, other second fiddle cities, you say, I don't think we have a lot of experimental theater. I think that since, let's say, the early 70s or mid-70s, experimental theater, which you might find in Chicago, maybe even some in L.A., I don't know about that, really is not here. I mean, you know, we have Mobius, which has been around forever, a very small experimental theater. But besides that, there's not much to speak of in terms of that. I would say also in terms of new plays, I would say, again, Boston has gotten a little better. But unlike Chicago and some other even second fiddle cities, let's say if you want to call San Francisco a second fiddle city, we do not really do enough new work. And I wish we could see more new plays. I'm not saying we don't do any. I'm just simply saying that I would like to see more. We tend, like a second fiddle city, to do shows that have been successful elsewhere, particularly, let's say, off-Broadway, where people will, in fact, some theaters even say, we are Boston's off-Broadway.
That would be my theater, wouldn't it?
Well, I didn't want to say that.
Spiro,
yes.
Spiro was...
I wanted to let you steam over there.
No, hyperventilating is a better word.
Well,
Spiro,
I'm going to tell you why I'm hyperventilating.
Anyway, my point is we are a second, you know, we are a healthier second fiddle city than we have been before. Now, in terms of tryouts, for example, it is interesting. As Spiro said, in the old days, we got a lot of major shows, big shows, before they went to New York.
I saw the Gin Game with Jessica Tandy and Hume Cronin when it was on tryout here
right.
in Boston.
Now, what's happening is that we're more of a second fiddle city in that we still have tryouts, but we are now essentially Boston and Broadway is owned by a multinational corporation, and we are one of a number of cities that they basically program for. And if you look for Broadway in Chicago or Broadway in L.A., all of which are owned by this sort of mega conglomerate, they see basically the same shows that we see. In other words, they have a certain number of shows that they're trying out for Broadway. They might put one or two new ones here, but generally they're all playing the same number of cities. That's different than the old days where you tended to have, I mean, well, the old days meaning, let's say, back in the 70s and the 80s, which I know about, where you had independent producers.
Okay, let me give...
Who, in a sense, could bring in what shows they wanted to bring in that they thought would be good for Boston audiences. These shows are not something like 1,000 Clowns or so forth, not necessarily being brought in simply because they think it's good for Boston audiences.
Okay, let me give Spiro Valutis a chance to comment, and then to Carmelo Riley.
Well, the reason I'm hyperventilating over here is I, having carried the standard of Boston theater for so very long, the idea of Boston as being a second fiddle city in any sense of the word, I think, is part of the problem. If it's not from New York, it's not good. That's something that audiences tend to think, and that's something that's promulgated, frankly, by the media. The fact that you said, well, Boston's a second fiddle city. Why should we be a second fiddle city? We've got some... Frankly, American Repertory Theater is probably one of the best regional repertory theater companies in the United States. So is the Huntington Theater Company. Our mid-sized theater companies like the New Repertory Theater and, yes, the Lyric Stage Company of Boston, I would put them up against medium-sized theaters in any part of this country.
I use that term simply to be provocative. But
well,
as it
you
happens,
certainly provoked me.
I spent a lot of time in Minneapolis, and I was there when the Guthrie began, and then the Guthrie came to the fore. And they are happy to put that against anything in the States.
I agree
with you.
I just came back from Philadelphia, and I saw some theater down there that was fabulous. So the whole idea of a centralized theater center being New York, I think that whole idea in the last 40 years, certainly since the beginning of the regional theater movement, has changed. And I think Boston, frankly, is behind the curve on that because we do have great theater here. Maybe we don't have every kind of theater here. And I agree with Bill. We really do need to do more locally written plays because if you look at Chicago, where did David Mamet come from?
I mean, they gave birth to the careers of a number of major playwrights. We have yet to do that. That to me is one mark of a major theater town. You have to nourish first-rate talent. And also, this is where we disagree a little bit here. We have to keep them here. And I still feel that New York and other places draw away some of our best talent, and we need to create an economic environment where we can keep these people here.
We don't disagree about that.
I think that realistically we do have to, you know, while it's disheartening to talk about New York and Boston, there is an element. We're all on the East Coast and we're right beside each other. Mm-hmm. And I experience it actually in a slightly different way because some of the plays that I do are emanating from London and from Dublin. And I'm finding increasingly, and this may not have been the case a few years ago, that when I apply for rights, there is this belief with playwrights now, Irish playwrights and English playwrights, that they may make the big score, which is New York, so they're reluctant sometimes to give the rights. Mm. I've been very fortunate and really to get the rights to some of the plays that I've got, but it's concerning me somewhat. So that there is a logistic thing going on there. You know, Chicago's far out there. It's a way out in another world in some respects on this vast continent. In Boston, there are other issues at play, and it's not about whether the work is good or bad. It's about funding. It's about support for the theatre. It's the tradition of music in this town. It's perhaps that theatre wasn't what this community supported. And that is changing. There is a burgeoning. You were mentioning Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. I happened to be talking to... this town is full of fantastic designers. Susan Zeman Rogers, who designed for us last year, was out in Minneapolis at with the Jeune Lune Theatre, I think. But she came back to us with a rather interesting article from the Minneapolis, I don't know what the actual newspaper is there.
Star Tribune,
in which it was an article about theatre. But Boston, it said, where was the most, where was the renaissance of theatre? And Boston was number 7. I don't think that's not bad in some respects.
No, considering we're number 6 in size.
I think we kind of badmouth ourselves a little bit too much. We're undervalued. We sometimes undervalue ourselves.
You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien, and our guests are Bill Marks, the WBUR critic of theater and the arts in general, Carmel O'Reilly, who is the producing artistic director of the Sugan Theater Company, and from the Lyric Stage Company of Boston, producing artistic director Spiro Voloutis. And we're talking about the state of theater in Boston, what there is to see and where we might go. Let's pursue a little bit more formally the changes over the past 25 years. What if you had to pick out the single biggest change? What would that be?
Well, it's just difficult to say what the biggest change is. I would say I would agree with Carmel that certainly the growth of small theaters is definitely one of the large. You know, when I first came here in the early 80s, there were a handful of good small theaters, but only a handful. So that has grown. So I'd say that's certainly a change. Certainly the coming of the ART and the Huntington Theater Company. I mean, again, that's just such a huge change. And I agree with Spiro that, of course, that does put us on the national map. There's just no doubt about it. I'm sometimes disappointed in what they do, and they don't use their clout in the way that I wish they would by doing more new plays, better new plays, maybe taking a few more risks. I do think that when you get a big subscription list, you tend not to want to take challenges. But still, the fact that they're there is also big. And also, I think the whole tryout mentality is now dead. Hmm. And even though Broadway in Boston is trying to make us believe that this is like one of the greatest downtown seasons in 20 years. I mean, essentially, we are getting the same sort of material that any other city is getting around the country. So I'd say the biggest change is the absolute end of even the idea of the tryout, really, it seems to me. The growth of small theater and then the establishment of regional theaters.
I have to agree with Bill. I think that in any major theater city, there are flagship theaters, flagship regional theaters like the Huntington and ART. And that sort of pulls everything else along. The other thing that I would say is the big difference, I think, and you touched on it, is trying to keep people here in Boston, is the fact that Carmel and smaller theaters like hers at a time paid nothing to the artists. I mean, I remember a time when I was working for a theater of great stature in the city, and it played major roles for it and did not get paid at all. And you sit there and you say, well, okay, well, you have to pay your dues and you have to do this, but I also have to pay my rent and I also have to do a lot of other things. You know, artists buy things and rent and purchase and
actually
do all those
eat.
Things.
I understand wear
occasion,
clothing and that.
On
yes.
occasion, we do, and I think that is also an important factor of what's happened over the last 25 years. Is that there were several companies that said this is no longer right, and that group of theaters, I was one of them at the time, we said that this was no longer right, and we started to at least pay something or actually have a written contract. And the, so the professionalism that, that Bill alludes to, and he's absolutely right, of what has been happening in Boston in the last 25 years, that I think is a big part of it. We've got to do better because we do lose a lot of artists, and it's terrible. We talked about Susan Zeman Rogers just a moment ago. I worked with a great lighting designer, Yael Lubetsky, who throughout the country right now, she's considered one of the best lighting designers in the country. She had to leave Boston to get that recognition and to make the kind of money that she needs to make her living. John Malinowski is another person, you know, Susan, Jay Hagenbuckle, let alone the countless numbers of actors that have come through this city, some who have gone on to do, you know, major things, and we can't keep them here for a season or two. I talk to a lot of young actors, and it's always, oh, I'm going to New York, and that's, we lose them.
But do you think that's changing with people like Susan and John Malinowski? They can go float out of Boston to work elsewhere while still working and still maintaining their residence here. I think that is changing. And it's also true that we have more actors who are staying around because the work is there and because we're making a better effort to pay them.
Right.
We always, even when we were very small, tried to give a nominal something to our actors and our technical people. And we've always made that an objective, you know, ongoing.
I still think that even in Boston, some of the top paid people in Boston or those people who are the busiest still aren't really making what I would consider to be a living wage.
Okay.
And you it's a real mindset that is changing.
That is true about certainly early on when we set up the Sugon organization, she used to call us and say, it'll be free exposure for you.
I'm gonna...
And it drove me crazy because it was so much work and all those actors had to be pulled together and rehearsals had to be done. And, you know, the attitude was, well, we'll build your audience. And we did it sometimes in order to build the audience, actually.
Carmel O'Reilly, Bill Mark.
Everyone's agreeing too much here. I mean, I would say that something that I've always found true from the 80s, even now, is that I think there are too many companies. I would like to see a little less activity to the extent that I've often felt that what would help economically and artistically, if you had a strong artistic director who would pull together the best actors, the best designers, the best everybody, and bring them together. And I often felt, and I still even today feel that, although a little less when I first started, that I see too many companies with all these actors and designers and directors, and I see a talented director there, and I see a good actor in another company, and I see a good costume designer somewhere else. I said, if somebody could just, like a magnet, bring together the best, then it seems to me that's what we need. That's and to a certain extent, I would say that we need I'm not talking about people in this room, but I mean, we need stronger artistic directors who are willing to be a little more merciless, perhaps, and just go out, bring the best of the best together and create seasons that I think then maybe will help generate some more money and will certainly help concentrate the talent that we have here, because I've always found it diffuse.
But isn't that really happening? There's not one company that's pulling everybody together, but at any given time during the season, you can't hire every actor in town, even the good ones. So there have to be more job opportunities for those artists. But you see John Malinowski, we keep bringing up names, but you see John design at Sugon, design at the Lyric, design at the New Rep. You see, you know, actors like Phil Patrone working at the New Rep and with my company. And this year, thankfully, for the first time, you started to see Boston actors on the stage at the Huntington. So isn't that really happening? Perhaps we have too many companies, but, you know, you don't say there are too many banks. You know,
well,
you don't say there are too many stock brokerages.
I do. Well, there are. I mean, there may be too many banks and there may be too many stock brokerages. And I do think that there are too many companies, although I do think it's gotten a little. I agree with you that it's gotten. It was used to be when I first came here in the early 80s, it was just terrible.
Okay.
Let me ask you
the one thing that concerns you, Bill, and that's, in your view, the lack of avant-garde or cutting-edge plays.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think new plays period. Mm-hmm. I know Spiro was just at a meeting, a theater meeting, the TCG. I mean, the statistics that I've seen coming out of them over the past few years has been that even at the major regional theaters, new play production is going down.
It is.
They are doing fewer and fewer new plays. So the future of drama, which is based on getting new plays, is now being slided, I think, and you can argue with me, because the subscription audience wants to be reassured that they're going to like what they see, and they want familiar names and familiar material there. And so,
well,
and
I think
that's
it's trying to
Boston.
Find a balance too. I mean, I produce 7 shows a year, and you try to find a balance between those things that are new, that may be a chestnut every once in a while, because you do have to remember that without an audience, there is no theater, not just in terms of economics, but in terms of the art form. This is the only art form that really requires an audience. You know, music, the musician can play in their, living room and still create music. We cannot create theater without that audience. The audience is the last cast member to show up. So you have to deal with the needs of the marketplace, but you also have to try to find a balance between the marketplace and, experimental work.
No, but I agree with you, but I'm just saying that old balance, obviously, since there are fewer new plays being done, is being eroded as people begin to play it safe more and more.
Right.
And don't do that one show every season. They said, I want to do this because it's a new play and it interests me and it may challenge my audience. Let's go for it. And I'm just saying fewer companies are willing to take that chance now.
But I think that's true, but I think it's also true that Boston theater audiences are changing. And part of what's happening is they're a kind of education when you go to theater. And in actually going to theater, you're already bringing people into the mix, and it may be easier to introduce new plays. And in fact, I see a lot of theater companies as that being an objective and a goal and a realistic, not something they're just talking about doing, but planning to do. And we had the opening of the Market Theater Place, talking about the Marketplace in Harvard Square. Now, we've only had 2 productions. We don't know where it's going. But that happened. We also had...
That happened, but I think the Market Theater is well-named, because at the moment it's all marketing, and the new plays that I've seen have not all been all that new. One other thing I have to say is the age question, which is...
Yes.
I mean, they have huge symposium. I was reading about it in London in terms of the fact that the theater demographically is skewing older and older. I mean, the only time... I mean, I'm now 47, and the only time I feel like a young buck now is when I go to the theater, because generally I tend to be one of the younger people in the audience. Certainly when I go to the Huntington and sometimes even the ART, I feel like a young colt. The problem with that is that... A younger audience is not developed the habit of going to theater, being interested in theater. And part of what theater going is habit. It's not, you saw something you liked and you want to see it again. If these younger people have not grown up with the habit of going to see theater, where are you going to get your audience from as this older generation begins to go?
I think that's the challenge.
One of the things that has changed in Boston is this increasing diversity in the population in the greater Boston area. Has that been met by a comparable diversity in theater? Say Hispanic, Haitian, Portuguese?
I'd say no.
No.
I'd say absolutely no.
I mean, agree.
I want to say a disgrace may be too strong, but for example, the Huntington Theater, this has its black play slot, and it did Amen Corner this year. And I'm going, well, A, why didn't they do a new play isn't there someone besides August Wilson that they could find to produce? But besides that, what black theater company has there? Why do we have to wait for the black play in the Huntington Theater slot to see a play? I don't want to just mention, but any of the sort of diverse groups that you're talking about, they're simply a Hispanic theater group. Mm-hmm. Is there an ongoing one? I've never heard of one.
But there is an ongoing African-American group that started at the Boston Center for the Arts in January. Now, I did not see that play.
I'm just saying that over in 20-year period, there have been groups that have lasted for a year or two or for a few years. There have been few that have been able to, like Shugan, who've been able to create an organization, a set pattern of productions and have lasted... for a number of years. I've never quite understood why that is, but it has not happened.
Okay, at this point, I just like to remind people that they're listening to Boston University World of Ideas. That's Bill Marks, critic at large. With us also, Carmel O'Reilly, the artistic director of the Shugan Theater Company and the producing artistic director of the Lyric Stage Company, Spiro Valudis. Now, how does Boston and Boston audiences reflect the national theater? Does it reflect the national theater? Is there a national theater, Bill?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm a little hazy about the question here. I mean, there, if you mean there is a national theater in the sense of theater that, you know, there are plays that everyone does. You know what I mean? There are popular plays like Proof, for example, which was a big hit in New York. Mm-hmm. You're going to see it everywhere in the coming year. I guess you could call that a national theater. I'm not sure that's necessarily a good thing in this, but in the sense that it tends to happen in New York and maybe in Chicago, where a certain number of plays or playwrights become popular or hot, and then suddenly everyone else is doing them. I mean, the idea of a national theater is interesting in the sense that, like everything else, particularly in the fine arts, years ago when Arthur Miller did a play, let's say, premiered All My Sons or Death of a Salesman, you went to a cocktail party and people were talking about Arthur Miller and you got to see this new play. I mean, mm-hmm. the theater was close to what you would say would be a central cultural interest. It dealt with issues in such a way and people were interested in seeing it. We haven't had that for years and I'm not sure when it's ever going to come back. I mean, maybe Mamet a bit when they did Glengarry Glen Ross and people were saying, well, you've got to go and see that. But it doesn't really happen very often in terms of the in that sense, the idea of, you know, audiovisual, of digital, of movies and so forth really has pushed aside theater, it seems to me, as being part of the national conversation. Only when theater is shocking, quote unquote, when you see something like Corpus Christi by mm-hmm. Terrence McNally, which was a retelling of the Gospels, you know, with lots of homosexuality tossed in, mm-hmm. that theater suddenly becomes important. I myself find that to be the wrong kind of notoriety, frankly. I mean, we have to shock people or have someone boogalooing nude or doing something I think sort of ridiculous just to get attention. Yeah. But theater as national theater, meaning a theater that's of interest to the population, if that's what you're talking about, I think that those days are gone. And to a certain extent, theater, like everything else, is fragmented, meaning people are going to go see the kind of theater that they want to see that fits into what they, you know, the kind of theater that they care about. But it isn't necessarily going to be that everyone is going to be talking about what happens in theater.
I really can't speak to the nation, the United States. I mean, my experience is really in Boston. I think that there are some changes going on. And I think part of that is that perhaps the audiences around Boston had been experiencing like Broadway in Boston or theater from some of the bigger companies. I think there is a new joy in being part of that smaller kind of experience.
Spiro?
Well, I don't think there's a national theater. I think it's regional. Mm-hmm. I think to try to say what someone might be interested in seeing in Lubbock, Texas is not exactly what somebody would want to see in Boston, Massachusetts. Or California or Chicago. So I think that theater, unlike the mass media, really should be addressing, as Carmel said, what's happening locally.
Okay, but are there national trends in subject matter, in staging styles, in the use of music? Are there things that are creeping in all over? There was you mentioned Terrence McNally's play. There was a staging at the ART of Richard II, which was, you know, clearly over the top in terms of homoerotic expression, correct?
Well, I agree. I'm not sure. I don't see enough theater around the country to say that there is a lot of homoeroticism going on, although certainly
shock
that would
tactics.
Be... The shock tactics have been, and unfortunately will always be, you know, because there are some people, and actually some intelligent people, who seem to confuse, you know, what you would call new theater or experimental theater with shock theater, which I don't necessarily think that they are one and the same. Something can be experimental and new and also perhaps be subtle and disciplined and modulated. So, you know, we have a confusion of terms there, and it's also going to my earlier point about marketing. I think that part of ways of marketing say we're cutting edge, and the cutting edge is supposed to be shock. So you do get something like Richard II, which frankly I think was partly there, you know what I mean, to be shocking and supposedly thus to be, you know, avant-garde and experimental. And I thought that was unfortunate. There are certainly trends. For example, we seem to be getting into a new science idea. I mean, the success of Copenhagen, for example, by Michael Frayn, mm-hmm. and then the success of Proof, which is about a father-daughter mathematical genius pair, mm-hmm. indicates that there's some interest in bringing, and I think that's actually not a bad idea if it can actually bring ideas into the theater, which is mm-hmm. part of what made, you know, someone like Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller powerful in the 50s, is that they seem to deal with issues or ideas that interest the audience. And we seem to have gone away from that.
And yet I don't think you'd ever say that Tennessee Williams or Arthur Miller were experimental.
Oh, the glass menagerie was, wasn't it?
I don't think, but see, maybe we have just a different idea of what experimental means. Glass Menagerie was written because a producer wanted Tennessee Williams to write a play so that he could produce it. And so was, Elia Kazan did a lot of work with Tennessee Williams because they wanted to produce the play in New York. I don't see that as being what you... I'm not sure what we mean by experimental again. That's a little fuzzy.
You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Our guests are WBUR critic Bill Marks, Carmel O'Reilly from the Sugan Theater Company, and Spiro Valutis of the Lyric Stage. What is theater anyway? Or maybe we should say, why theater? TV, cable, movies, DVD, the internet, video games, radio. What does the theater do for us?
Well, I just think that probably in terms of what's going on sociologically is that we've become more insular. You know, people are at their computers, they're watching film. It's a very kind of personal, isolated experience, whereas theater is about community. It's warm bodies. You don't know what's going to happen. It's flesh and blood. And there's an excitement to that.
Partly, isn't theater about the word, the words? Not just the actions, but the words.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, we get into this thing about, you know, theater is about words. Theater is not about words. Theater is about people. And it always has been. And I think it's the only art form, as I said, that has what my directing teacher once called a reciprocal response experience. The actor on stage says something or does something and gets a response immediately from the audience. Mm. You don't get that in film. You certainly don't get that by playing a video game. And I think, ultimately speaking, we are going to break... if I can vision for a second, I think people are going to want to touch people and be with people at some point. Regardless if it's, you know, a sporting event or if it's theater, you know, we all know watching a sporting event on television is not the same thing as being at sporting event. And I think that as we keep going into the digital age, oddly enough, that was the subject of this conference that I just came back from. As we go into the digital age, we've got to decide how are we going to bring those people out of that insular shell. You know, 10 years ago, it was the cocooning of people, and that buzzword has gone away. Now it's insular. Now it's whatever it is. But I think theater's been around for a very, very long time. Do I think it's going to continue? Yes. Do I think it's going to continue without us having some strategy about changing it? Maybe not. I think we have to start thinking as theater artistic directors and as theater people to come up with a strategy that's going to want to bring people into that dark room, I keep calling it.
Okay, Bill Marks. We've talked about the battle with TV, cable, movies, DVDs, films.
It's not a battle to the extent, for example, Broadway is doing gangbusters.
Right.
It's like the all-time big Soccer-Rooney season. So,
well, wait a minute.
The digital age in movies, the producers was a movie.
It's a musical based on a movie.
That's what I'm saying. They're working hand in hand.
But proof isn't.
No, proof isn't, although proof has someone who's sort of known for some of her movie work and so forth in The Star.
I mean,
I'm just saying they're working, particularly on Broadway. The digital age, the star age, the celebrity age is working well. I mean, I'm less worried about where commercial theater is going to go because I think commercial theater will continue to survive because it will be working hand in hand with the digital age. I think the art of theater, if I may say so, which doesn't get talked about enough, the theater as an art, I think, is a more precious, more fragile, and more endangered beast. And how that's going to survive, I'm not sure. I certainly know what its rewards are, which is a far greater than the sort of commercial theater you get. I mean, you're getting something that stimulates you intellectually, emotionally, something that is now happening present before you. It cannot be repeated. It will never happen again. And you're feeling warm bodies by you. I sort of agree with Spiro. I simply turn that by saying that it's about people knowing other people are around them. It's not just you looking at the TV laughing at a comedian because people are talking to their TVs like crazy. Go to the movies. They're talking back to the movies now. It's that you're aware of other people being around you. So it is that a collective communal experience which gives gives it part of it, part of its meaning.
I do think that the way plays have been written has changed, and it reflects actually something about the way films are made. Mm-hmm. I'm reading a lot of plays now, and they're like scenarios from film scenes, and actually a little hard to stage because you've got them going from one place to another very quickly. So that is changing. Secondly, some of the staging has become stark, often very brilliant in terms of set design, but that's changing. A lot of that realism has disappeared, even for realistic plays.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, there have been a number of monologue-style plays recently, quite a few, and some of them are marvellous. I mean, I did love St. Nicholas and Slime Tree Bar, and I put them on, Bill.
I know.
And the public loved them,
already,
and there is a magic to that.
I invented my...
But there has certainly been a proclivity.
To me, I think that's a problem. You know, that goes to... I think everything you said is really right on. I mean, mm-hmm. I do think we have more and more playwrights who want to be screenplay writers.
Mm-hmm.
And I myself don't like the monologue. I think the monologues are here, A, for economic reasons. In other words, they're cheap to produce. You have mm-hmm. one person, two or three people. Two, they seem more like short story readings at times. You know, in other words, it isn't a dramatic experience. Mm-hmm. We're having one character facing off, let's say, simply with another character. You're having people, in a sense, sitting down, and it seems vaguely... You know, like you were listening to a story. And I don't think theater is story. I actually don't. I mean, I do think theater can contain a story, but theater is not narrative. I mean, I think there's like you have characters that there's conflict. They're not there to say, let me tell you a story. You know, they're not. We're not at the campfire where someone is saying, now let me tell you the story of X. You're at the campfire, but you have two different characters or three different characters all interacting, all mm-hmm. with dialogue, all hopefully clashing or saying interesting things to one another. That forms the story. They're not telling us a story. And I find, and I myself am really irritated by that. And I think it goes to the idea that, well, what's different than, what can we do that's different from film? And that's different from film, but that's also fairly cheap to produce. And so we don't, instead of doing, you know, a restoration comedy, you do something with three people yakking away for 2 hours. I mean,
but if you have three people yakking away in the format that you've just said, where there is conflict, then that three
That's
person
That's fine
play
if there's
fun.
Conflict, but I
tend to agree about the monologue style play. I saw Carmel's wonderful production of Lime Tree Bower, where she tried desperately to get these people to connect with one another, and I know that the script didn't quite allow that to happen. I know that the same thing happened with a production of Molly Sweeney that Scott Edmonston directed, where he tried to get people to make these kind of connections, and the play just didn't support it. So I have a similar feeling about that kind of monologue.
Well, it's not that I'm rising to the defense of that, because I think McPherson is a wonderful and beautiful writer. We're just getting into the whole debate of what theater is now. Is theater action? Is theater conflict? Is theater all of these things? I found when I was doing this Lime Tree Bar that, in point of fact, even through storytelling, and that is an issue, is it storytelling? Is it not? Where did theater begin? I think it began with storytelling, with telling a story with action in it, and then it became acted out. But to be honest, I didn't desperately do that. That happened in the process of rehearsal. Mm-hmm. It was not, it came very easily, in a sense, mm-hmm. to me, to make this sort of odd connection between them. It became a string or something that linked them in some strange way, an unseen and invisible line between them all.
Yeah. There was a connection between those people that I didn't think was particularly supported by the text, but it came out of the production that you put together.
The bad part
of the
trend.
That's the joy of being a director.
Look, the bad part of the trend to me is that economics is shaping the imagination of what's happening on the stage. And that, to me, ultimately is limiting and narrowing. I mean, I don't say we don't have to be, you don't mm-hmm. have as many characters as Shakespeare, and I don't want Shakespeare again. He won't be here again. But still, when you see the wealth and the complexity of what's going on, and then you see what's happening today where economically playwrights can only have two or three characters. They have, you know what I mean, they can only have so many scene changes. They may think they're dealing with an audience that has an attention span because they've been trained by movies and TV of only 3 minutes before they want a switch in topic. It seems to me that that's all completely detrimental, and perhaps maybe that's what I was talking about, the fragility of the art of theater. Mm-hmm. The art of theater is endangered by that.
Why do you do theater, Bill?
I don't do theater.
No, well, I mean,
I am a performer in a way as a critic on radio, though. I mean, there is a performance aspect. I create a persona, you know, the person you hear on the radio is not necessarily the real me. I do want to entertain my listeners, and as such, I'm going to write in a way that I, you know, create a character.
But you have become a theater critic. Why criticize theater then? Maybe that's what I'm...
Because it goes back to sort of the response syndrome,
you
know, or whatever Spiro was going on about.
Response experience.
I have, from the word get-go, I've always, when I've read a book or seen a film or gone to the theater, I have always not only felt it in my gut, and I've always wanted to share it. I've mm-hmm. wanted to respond to it because I honestly see it not as a criticism, as something to put something down, but as a part of a dialogue. I want to share my thoughts and articulate my reactions to other people to say, this is what I saw, this is what I felt. Did you see the same thing? Did you feel the same thing? And then just hash it out, because it seems to me that that's part of the intellectual delights of criticism. I mean, we have a very negative view of criticism, and God knows, given some of the practitioners, it's deserved. But criticism, when done right, should be sort of a form of sort of, I think it should be a delight and a joy, because you are responding to art, and you are, in a sense, taking art seriously by talking about it.
Carmel O'Reilly, why do you do theater?
Because I can't not do it. What kind of grammar is that? I don't know. But essentially, if I didn't do theater, my life would be so empty. Through theater, through reading plays, processing them, casting them, living through the research, what's happening when that play starts to go up and manifest itself. I mean, it's just words on the page beforehand. When you put actors there, and it's all about that, it's all about their skills and all about their talent and the designers. When they come together and they create something magical, and you experience it, and an audience experiences, and sometimes a critic experiences, and sometimes you experience it all together. That's what we're talking about, that common experience that people have in a community. They're walking out, and in a sense, they're walking out in oneness because something happened to them, not just personally, but mm-hmm. as a group. That doesn't always happen, but that is the possibility for the kind of magic of theatre. May not always pull it off, but when you do, there's nothing like it. I grew up really in the countryside, in a farm in Ireland. But I can remember entertaining a friend when I was probably about 8 years of age with lies. But theatre isn't lies in a sense. It's about creating a whole world, an alternate world outside of where you are. And I can remember telling this friend of mine that I was taking ballet lessons because I loved to dance. Well, there was nowhere for me to take to ballet lessons, but I mentioned the sort of local close big town to me, which was Oma. And I created all my dances all around the kitchen. From corner to corner, she stood there in awe because I loved Rudolf Nureyev. So I would imitate all of that. And I think that's partly what it was, that I was always creating another world.
Spiro?
Well, I have to agree with Carmel. I have no other marketable skills. So, but it's not just that. It is to do theater or to do any art, and let's not just say theater, but to do any art and to try to do it as a living takes great sacrifice. And to be in a group of people that are making that same kind of sacrifice in order to create something is a real exciting job, you know, if you call it a job. But it's because I can't see me not doing it mm-hmm. because of I've done it so long, and B, that's all I've ever done.
Well, what
so.
Drew you into it? What was the influence that Spiro Valutis?
I auditioned for a play when I was in junior high school. I got the lead, and
he hasn't looked back.
And I haven't looked back. I mean, it's truly that simple. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, along the way, there have been great influences in my life, certainly, you know, but that was really what started it. It was kind of this love of performing, you know, and you can see it. I mean, I have a very good friend who has a child, and she's also an actress, and the child is already performing, you know, and is it inbred? I don't know if it is or not, but there is a. Just this feeling that there is nothing else that you can do, or it's really the only thing that really makes me feel whole.
I have a friend who's a contemporary who harks back to the time when he was taking some film of his two daughters, who were a couple of years apart, and one was 4 and the other was 2, and the 4-year-old was busy dismantling the tricycle. Mm. To see how it worked. And she went on to become an engineer, and now she's studying to be a doctor. And the two-year-old was mugging for the camera and smiling and happy, and she's an actress in New York,
right.
so maybe it is genetic.
Who knows how? You know, my mother once said to me, if you shine a flashlight on somebody, either their hands go up in the air or they start acting. So it's like, you know, and I started acting.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. That was Spiro Valudis of the Lyric Stage. Our other guests are Carmel O'Reilly of the Sugan Theater Company and Bill Marks, WBUR's theater critic. So, where is Boston Theater going, and will it be able to express what we've been talking about, what theater really is, or what it ought to be? Or is it going to be more and more Broadway road shows, good solid plays that we've all seen before, revivals of Miller and Williams? What?
I think we're going to see some new plays. I think that Boston, just stepping right away from the theater scene, right into the city of Boston itself, it's become a city that people is desirable to live in. And part of that desirability is the quality of life. The city, at long last, is beginning to realize that if it is not invested in its in the arts and humanities, that the city will fail. I don't know too much about the past, but it strikes me that in past administrations, not too much money went to the arts. Not too much money is going right now, but it's a big start. For the first time, we have a cultural fund. Hopefully that's going to expand, and we've got to talk about those things, and we have got to let it be known that that needs to be supported by the city, and it is being supported by the city. So I do see new plays, more money, more support, broader audiences, and I'm hopeful.
I think that the Boston theater scene is going to continue to grow. I think much the same way that Bill says that unless we start to find playwrights, we will not have our own indigenous theater. Not to pat myself on the back, but that's part of what I hope to do in the next 3 years is to start commissioning some new plays.
At the Lyric Stage.
Well, yep. As long as I'm working there.
Sure.
and hopefully in that mix of six or seven plays, we're going to start to see some new plays. Yes, we did a play that was new. You know, I made a commitment 3 years ago when I became the artistic director at the Lyric Stage to do a new play within a world premiere within 3 years. It was very successful for us. I'm already starting to talk with a couple of playwrights in the area, people that I think audiences are starting to know their names as playwrights, as well as actors and et cetera. But unless we start to encourage that playwriting, not just at the small level. There are some wonderful theaters in Boston that are encouraging playwriting, like Center Stage, mm-hmm. And you know the Playwrights Theater on Comm Avenue. But until some new plays start to make it into what I consider the mainstream of Boston theater, that's not going to happen. And, you know, it works its way up. You have the smaller companies, then if the medium-sized mm-hmm. companies start to do some new plays, hopefully the larger regional theaters will start to look at new Boston plays.
Bill Marks, where do you think Boston theater is going?
Well, I mean, I'm hoping everything that was just said comes to fruition, you know, that new plays are done, that new resources are put into it. As usual, I have to cast a somewhat skeptical note on the idea that, I mean, there's excitement in the media about all the new theater and new theater spaces are being built and are going to be developed. And that's one thing, on the one hand, that we've needed, new theater spaces. And a lot of smaller theaters in particular have needed some place to go. The idea is that if you're successful in a small theater, now you can maybe take it to a slightly larger one and maybe make some money or at least do better there. I'm a little skeptical of it. I'm skeptical of it because I'm just wondering whether in the need to get money or to make money, part of it is that you want to develop. You want to, you know, you keep saying we're building new stages, more new stages. That means more resources have to go into those new stages. That means more, you know what I mean? That means more economic pressure on companies, which maybe have one theater worry about now. Let's say the Huntington now having a second theater, they're also going to have to worry about. So I'm a little, I want it to happen, and I'm glad to see the growth, but I don't think that people are making the point that there is the negative side, that just expanding doesn't necessarily mean that quality is going to improve.
And you're concerned at dilution, as you mentioned
earlier.
And
I'm concerned that that as bureaucracies grow and as marketing, particularly talking about now the larger regional theaters, mm-hmm. we have more, you know, you're having more and more top-heavy bureaucracy of people who are basically there to market the theater. They're making their salaries. in order to keep the theater growing and bring more and more money in, and there's more attention paid to that than the quality of what you see on the stages.
What, in the end, is the theater-goer supposed to take away from the experience, whether it's with your Irish and Scottish plays, Carmel O'Reilly, or with the diversity that you're trying to bring to the Lyric stage, or with what you see night after night in theaters ranging from 40-seaters to 4,000? What is the theater-goer supposed to be taking away?
I think the theater-goer, when he leaves that theater and walks down the street, that he's provoked in some way, he or she provoked in some way. There's a provocation that it challenges them to think about some of the issues that might have been addressed, that it gives them a thirst, if you like, for more, a taste for more, and that they want to come back and do it again, either at my theater or at some other theater. Mm-hmm. And that it will come back into their minds, perhaps in the days to follow. Maybe not right then.
Carmel used two words of the three words that I constantly use about what theater should do. It needs to entertain, it needs to challenge, and it needs to provoke. It has to do at least two of those three things at any one given time. You're not always going to get all three. But at least if it does those three things, I think that and an audience member goes away with those things, they're going to go back for more, and they're going to have that thirst that you speak of.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's a rare experience. Sometimes I feel like I'm going across the desert, and occasionally I hit an oasis, and then it's back in the desert. The idea is an experience of theater, which is, as the critic Coleridge said, is something that should touch the head and the heart. And there is a particular, and I cannot describe it, and I've tried, a particular something, that state of being that comes over me when I'm seeing some theater that's really stimulating. I'm both thinking and feeling. The engine is running, and everything is just absolutely running in complete, just super smoothly. I'm both being moved and thinking about something at the same time.
There's no business like show.
You've been listening to a Boston University World of Ideas roundtable discussion on theater in Boston. Our guests have been Sugan Theater Company Artistic Director Carmel O'Reilly, the Lyric Stage Company's Producing Artistic Director Spiro Voloutis, and WBUR Theater Critic Bill Marks. Join us again next week for the first of the annual lectures by Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. We'll be presenting the lectures on the next three Sundays. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. You can join the conversation at wbur.org and wrni.org. Our webmaster is Angel Cazelli. Tonight's program was produced by Vince Fairchild and Bob Zalisk. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.
This is WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Surface Works of Watertown and Concord, a professional cleaning service because it's nice to come home to a clean house. 617-926-7633. Boston University will host information sessions on July 11th and 17th for degree programs in management studies concentrating in e-commerce or innovation and technology management. Both the July 11th and 17th sessions are at BU's new